The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You're joining We the People Radio. With Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And our engineer.
Bob Horton.
We make him talk for himself. We make him speak occasionally. Oh my gosh. Well, then.
Greetings, Aaron and Bill.
Another action-packed week.
Did you go to the rodeo, Bob?
I did not.
The big question is, did you stay long enough for the monsoon at whatever that was, 12:30 or 1 o'clock this morning? It's like, what is that?
Were you out there at 12:30?
No, but I could hear it. It was like, what is that?
I was out. I was out on the town about, oh, hell, I didn't get home until 3 in the morning. I'm kind of a wild guy, you know. On the weekends, it's hard to keep up with me.
Even when Bill was young, he didn't do that.
You're giving me up.
Because it just doesn't make any sense. Oh, my gosh. Well, all righty. We are swiftly calling our guest for this hour. Well, for both hours, actually, Lauren Spivak. So if you are listening to us in Philadelphia, you'll have to tune into the website, wethepeopleradio.us, in order to catch Lauren, the rest of Lauren. But anyway, he has written a new book, third book. Okay, so wait, let's start at the beginning. First book was called The New Democrat. Super funny. I should have brought them, darn it. What was I thinking? Got them on the shelf. Should have brought them so we could have flipped through them. I know. Dope. Anyway, it's a parody history on the Obama administration based on a famous children's book, needless to say, The Cat in the Hat. And they're the same size. They're little hardback books. They're great, great gifts. And the humor is perfect, unless, of course, you're, you know, flaming liberal, in which case kind of make you angry. You might get one for a present.
Can you say flaming liberal?
Flaming and liberal, all in the same thing?
Yeah.
A flamer or a liberal?
Yeah.
No, I thought flaming liberal was actually much nicer. So Lauren kind of goes by the handle of the free market warrior. He was born and raised in Massachusetts, spent most of his adult life in New York City, and becoming active in politics, he worked in several nonprofits as a management consultant for both profit and nonprofit corporations. He does a terrific economics seminar, but he has a new one. He has a new seminar out, and we'll let him... and I think I botched the title. Hey, Lauren, are you in there already?
I am here.
What is the title of the new seminar?
Well, my new one, my third one, is called The Search for Superhuman Wisdom.
And somehow on the website it became The Wisdom. I was like, wait a second, that's not the name of it.
That is the Monarch Notes version of my seminar.
I'll be fixing that right now. I was like, wait a minute, it's not called The Wisdom. That sounds like some weird cult. Although that would be a great name for a cult, you know, in case you want to start one of those.
That's if you want the Reader's Digest abridged to the seminar.
We'll just cut right to the wisdom.
Maybe it's about teeth.
It is. It's something. Hey, so give folks a thumbnail sketch on both your seminars, because they're really good. But we've only seen the economics one. We haven't seen the superhuman wisdom one.
I don't think I've even done my second one with you guys, which is called Getting There From Here. They're all really different from each other in terms of the content.
Okay, we missed that.
Getting There From Here, which is officially the second seminar, is about developing a practical political strategy toward a smaller government. Because it struck me that, you know, say what you want about the Republican Party, I don't hear much of a peep out of them about how to actually make the government smaller than it is. And so that's what my entire second seminar is about. And the third one, the Search for Superhuman Wisdom, is probably the most intellectual of the three. It's about understanding the role of law and democracy and Congress and republics and how that all works together. It's understanding how you want to have a free society, where you need some law, because you can't let people just go around murdering other people, but where you want to maximize freedom. And we tackle some really interesting issues, I think, including that democracy doesn't work very well, and that there are alternatives to democracy. And when you say that to people, they think the only alternative to democracy is, you know, to have a totalitarian dictator. And I think just the opposite. There's those alternatives which actually work a lot better than democracy and are a lot fairer than democracy.
Well, that's kind of fun. Now, how long is that seminar?
All my seminars are 7 hours long.
Okay.
It's a format that I've gotten very comfortable with. We usually do them in 2 3.5-hour nights.
And you pretty much travel the whole country, and you will come and do that seminar at no charge for pretty much any group that can assemble itself in one place, right?
Yep, that is pretty much the story. I've done, amongst these seminars, I've done a seminar about 300 times now. I just did my first one in Tennessee just the last night, which is the 25th state that I've done seminars in now.
No fooling. Well, it is a great format.
Maine to San Diego.
And then you're on to San Diego?
No, I said I've done them from Maine to San Diego.
Maine to San Diego.
Entire length and breadth of the country.
Holy cow. And so we've listed your email on there. It's Lauren Spivak, Spivack, @gmail.com. And that's really an easy way for people to get a hold of you. And you always get right back to them and all that.
And I should say, I also, you know, usually, particularly with a new group, I give shorter talks on, you know, half-hour talks on an economic topic. I don't want people to think that I can't, that if I start talking, I can't stop in less than 7 hours.
That's true. I forgot about that.
I can do a shorter talk, too.
That's true. You do a really good warm-up talk. And then websites. Why don't we give folks that while we're on
the
details here?
Well, the website is mostly about my books, which is the other half of my life, is ObamaParody.com.
Okay, and we have that linked on there as well. And it's got the first two books, but I did add the cover. I'm figuring it's the front and back cover, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and I split them so that they would be big enough that people could see the detail, because they're really good. So we have The Wizard of Iz, which is the third book. And let's see, I told people the first one, The New Democrat. The second one is The Gorax, needless to say, modeled after the Lorax.
It's about environmentalism.
And it's really good. I mean, for anybody who is even halfway plugged in on what's happening in the environmental, the extreme environmental community, this ought to make you give you a good chuckle. So give people a little snap of, you know, a little elevator speech on The Wizard of Iz, and then we'll do more.
Well, sure. The broader theme is what I do in my books is I try to take, you know, important political economic ideas of our time and do them in a kind of a fun, friendly children's book form, which occasionally confuses people because they're not really children's books.
They just look like children's books.
Get emails from people saying, you know, we want to learn more about your children's books. And I say, I don't write children's books. They look like children's books.
But you know
but
what?
They're aimed at adults. And what they do is they tackle political issues of our time in a way that's very fun and accessible. They're picture books. The words are in the form of poetry, like a Dr. Seuss, for example. And so I find that, you know, in an age where people don't do a whole lot of reading, it's like a book for people who don't read. if you put it on your coffee table, you know, everyone will pick it up and read it, you know, even though they're not really, you don't have to be book people. And it makes a nice gift for, you know, people who aren't big on reading books per se, but everyone enjoys this because it's, you know, it's fun and it's quick and there's just humor. Or I think someone else suggested that my books are like really long political cartoons.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good way to put it.
It's a whole story done in a cartoon-like form. So anyhow, so my first one, The New Democrat, is about Obama, and the story of the Obama year is done as a parody of The Cat in the Hat. And my second one, The Gorax, is about Al Gore and environmentalism. And it's not quite as famous, but it's a parody of Dr. Seuss's book, The Lorax, and which is his, you know, pro-environmentalist book, you know, oh my gosh, capitalism is horrible. We have to defeat all the evil business people and have the environmentalists take over. And this is a parody of that, of how out of hand environmentalism has gotten, particularly by the way, in the state of California. Whenever I explain that the Gorax in California, my joke is that the original title was going to be the state of California, because you guys are my role model for what's going wrong with environmentalism.
My new one,
The Wizard of Oz, is obviously a parody of The Wizard of Oz, and it's essentially about Hillary and the 2016 presidential election, but it's more broadly about, you know, where our country has come to at this point in time. So there's a lot of, you know, not simply, you know, a one-dimensional story about Hillary. It's kind of the whole milieu in which, you know, Hillary is running for president, where there is, you know, where no one is really very honest anymore, and everything is corrupt and manipulated and spun, and we tackle the media and the academic world and just the whole, you know, the whole role of government and society. And what I decided to do was to have Dorothy be what she is in the original book, which is a, you know, teenage girl from circa 1900, and one of the twists that I made was I had the tornado blow her into modern times. So this is a kind of a time travel book, where she from 1900 finds herself in 2016 in the midst of Hillary's presidential campaign. And what she's doing is bringing her 1900 sensibilities to the world that we live in now. And how do you want me to go? You want me to kind of take this? You want me to go through plots or scenes? Or
either way, we've got to take a really quick break. And when we come back, so bottom line is you have about 2 minutes to decide, and then we'll just play along. Because honestly, you know, you're gonna have to tell us a lot of fun stuff so I can get this picture of cartoon Bill Clinton with no pants on out of my mind.
You know, Bill Clinton and his boxer shorts with hearts on them. Bill Clinton, I mean, you know, who can resist this?
Oh, my gosh.
I thought Bill Clinton made an awesome Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, he
because
would.
The original wizard in the original book, and what I always try to do in my parodies is, you know, make it very, you know, follow the narrative line of the original book as much as I can. That's what makes it funny. You recognize, you know, what the original story and how we've changed it. The original Wizard of Oz is a crook. I mean, he's a deceiver. In fact, on my quote page, I always do a quote page at the beginning. On my quote page, I have a line from The Wizard of Oz where he says, "If I should go out of this palace, my people would soon discover that I am not a wizard, and then they would be vexed with me for having deceived them." And you know, that's who The Wizard of Oz is. So it struck me that Bill Clinton is very much the wizard of today. They say it's all smoke and mirrors and there's nothing real anywhere. And I like the name Wizard of Oz because when they first meet him, they say, you know, are you the Wizard of Oz? And he says, well, that all depends on your definition of Oz. So that was kind of a gimme.
That was a freebie along with the no pants. I mean, those were.
Oh, I'm intrigued.
I've got to
get a copy of this book. I mean, you know, the material is endless.
I got a little snapshot of it when he was up in Wairika, and I'm like, I can't wait for this book. All right, we will be right back with you. For those of you that that have computers nearby, go to wethepeopleradio.us. Look at our page for today, and you will see the front and back page of The Wizard of Oz, and you'll know what we're talking about. We'll return with Lawrence Bevec in just a couple of minutes. What shall we do about them?
You're listening to We the People on AM 1460 KCNR.
Nice. So, a previous song, you know, What Shall We Do About Them? Now we're going to find out. All right, we're here with Lauren Spivak, talking about his new book, The Wizard of Iz. All right, so what'd you decide? Are we doing plot? Characters?
Well, I guess we might as well meander through the plot. Within the first page, Dorothy, who is essentially Dorothy, Dorothy gets blown by the tornado out of her, her world of 1900. You know, when the U.S. government was not even a half of 1% of our economy. You know, where there was no IRS, there was remarkably little government interference in people's day-to-day lives, particularly at the federal level. And in fact, the opening line of the book, if I may, it's one of my favorites, is once long ago, there was no IRS, no EPA, and no HHS. How did people survive? They just managed, I guess. and then Dorothy gets blown into 2016, and her house lands on Obama, and kills him, and she finds herself in the land of the free lunchkins, who have just discovered that they've been enslaved by Obama, and, you know, by extension, the whole, you know, welfare state. And so the first chapter is about the welfare state, how they came to realize that when you depend on government, you know, to get you your phone, your food, your school, your everything that you want, you actually end up losing your independence. And that it's very hard to struggle your way back from there. Once you bought into that, it's very hard to come back. And that's what the free lunchkins are dealing with.
The free lunchkins.
And yeah, well, yeah, no.
couldn't resist.
I get to make lots of puns. It's a fringe benefit of my unusual career.
Well, we were looking at the blow up at the bottom of the screen of the one page. I'm not sure where that page fits in the book, but it's the page that you sent me. And I couldn't cut it in half and blow it up like I did the cover and the front and back covers. But I did put it in a Word document so people could see it in a larger format. But Bill was looking at the... You even got in the Clinton email server with the word deleting on the screen. Is it... You didn't miss much.
Oh, there's so much on that page. You'll spend 5 minutes just looking at all the nooks and crannies and all the little things hanging on the wall. I mean, there's a ton of material just in this picture.
Yeah, Hillary.
You know, that's another thing I've tried to do in all the books is put in enough detail that you can go back and read it a couple times and pick up on things you missed the first time.
I like all the possible, you've got, oh my gosh, on here, like you've got three pictures, Hillary 1.0, Hillary 2.0, Hillary 3.0, and she moves into the Mao jacket. All the outfits. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And she doesn't change at all. She's just, you know.
It's just a different outfit, yeah.
Different changes are all completely superficial.
A new costume every time.
Okay, so talk about the who's the cowardly lion? Who else do we have?
Well, the cowardly lion becomes the cowardly rhino.
Yeah,
and obviously spelled without an H, and he's suspects that the Democrats are wrong. But he's too scared to do anything about it. And we're getting a little bit out of order because
oh, sorry.
Before, when she leaves the free lunch, because she wants to go back to America 1900. And that's, you know, she's like, I was happy then. I don't know what kind of craziness is going on now, but I want to get back. And they tell her, of course, the only person who could possibly get her back is the wizard, who, you know, is able to do everything. And they give her this red box that belongs to the witch, and nobody knows what's inside it, but the legend is that that's where, you know, that the secret to her power is in the red box. So they give it to Dorothy, and this was kind of, I was trying to pick up on the slippers, you know, theme that's
sure.
The original one,
right?
So anyhow, so it's this mysterious box that can't open. It's like one of those, you know, one of those toys where you can't figure out how to open the box, and we're not really sure what's there, except that everyone seems to value it very much. And so she heads on down the yellow brick road to find the wizard and get her problem solved. And the first person that she meets is the Scarecrow. And I was, again, I'm trying to pick up on what's originally there and then twist it in a modern way. The Scarecrow, you know, doesn't have a brain. And what I decided to make this about is education. Because so my Scarecrow has 14 graduate degrees from, you know, every Ivy League institution there is, but he still doesn't know anything. Because all of his degrees are in left-wing claptrap, which increasingly is what's being taught in the modern American university.
Yes.
And I'll tell you, you know, my daughter, as we speak, is in graduate school. She's pursuing a PhD in history in New York City. And I hear firsthand accounts of this every day. She's got students that she's teaching who major in poverty studies. this is like a subject to the modern American university.
That'd be real useful. Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? There's the path to a bright future.
Poverty studies.
Take that piece of paper out in the workforce and see where you go.
And she had another student whose major was indigenous studies. And, you know, then you've got the more well-known, you know, gay and lesbian studies and all of this. So the problem with the Scarecrow, because when Dorothy meets the Scarecrow and he says, I don't have a brain, she says, well, why don't you go to school and improve yourself? He's like, that's the problem. I've been in graduate school for decades, and I still don't know anything, and now I'm hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And I don't, you know, I may be exaggerating ever so slightly for comic effect, but not that much.
No. Unfortunately.
No, it is a sad
truth.
He
wants to actually get a brain at graduate school, having failed him. And so they go off together, as I'm sure, you know, people predicted they would, go off together. So the third character they meet is the Tin Man, who you may recall from the original doesn't have a heart. And I decided to make this one about taxes, because this is a theme I talk about in a lot of my talks, and, in, you know, from different perspectives, and it's something that I care very much about, is the misunderstanding that paying taxes is actually helping the less fortunate. That is an error that I'm very strongly dedicated to correcting. So the Tin Man has been told he doesn't have a heart because he doesn't like paying taxes, and he's troubled by this and wants to figure out how he can be compassionate enough so that he'll enjoy paying taxes, you know, once he gets a heart. And then if he, of course, joins them, and then we're to where you left off, which is the Cowardly Rhino, who is, of course, terrified of them. I wanted to have each of the characters have a little prop. And the Cowardly Rhino has a white flag that that he brings with him everywhere. And it actually, you know, he's a source of a lot of humor, because, you know, it's funny. He constantly is surrendering. So anyhow, so he's scared of everybody, particularly the Democrats and particularly the media. And they say, well, you know, if you know, we can get you some courage, then you might actually be able to do something useful. So he joins the group, of course. And the first big challenge they come to on their trip is there's a stream, which is it's called the Mainstream, and it's where the media are. So
the Mainstream.
You know, there's like a Mainstream media joke in here. And this is the replacement for the poppy field that's in the original book. So they've got to cross over the mainstream to get to the Emerald City, and it's full of all of these media outlets like, you know, like the New York Times and the MSNBC and Newsweek and Salon.com, and all of these, you know, left-wing mainstream media players are all blasting this left-wing propaganda at them. You know that there's no such thing as an IRS scandal, and Obamacare is doing a great job, and there's no inflation, the economy's fine, and Obama commands the respect of all the world leaders, and all of this nonsense, and they're all kind of intimidated by this media blasting at them, and of course the most of all is the cowardly rhino who just absolutely faints from fright in the middle of the stream. And so they have to drag him out to save him. And then they get to the Emerald City, and I may even take a second at this point to mention, I don't know if you guys even know this, but a lot of people, there's a whole school of thought that considers the original Wizard of Oz book by Frank L. Baum to be a political allegory of his time. I don't know if you ever run into this.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that the Emerald City was originally intended to be Washington, D.C., and that the Yellow Brick Road was about gold, and the slippers, which, you know, in the movie, the slippers are ruby, but that's because it was a color movie and they were playing around with colors. In the book, the slippers are silver, and it's about, the disagreement about U.S. monetary policy over gold and silver. So in some ways, you know, I had a kind of an allegory made to order here. But when they get to Washington, it's piled high with money. And I was trying to illustrate the fact that the only real boom town in America these days, you know, there was a time when, you know, Detroit was the big booming city in America because the auto industry was really taking off, you know, and it was, you know, at various times, various cities have had booms, and the boom today is in Washington because the way you make money is you get into Washington, which is where all the money goes.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much the only metropolitan area of the country where the economy is actually improving, where, you know, people are rich and there's money everywhere.
Lots of jobs.
Prices are going up. So I wanted to point that out. So they get to this city that's piled with money, and they want to see the wizard it is, and are directed to his palace, which is essentially the White House.
In his palace,
and they get inside, and what they find instead of this luxurious palace is this control room that, you know, with computers everywhere. You know, I was trying to make it look kind of like an air traffic controller, you know, center, where they've got the NSA listening to your phone calls, and they've got the internet over here, and they've got the Federal Reserve printing money over there, and the news media, and the welfare, and the food stamps, and it's all being centrally controlled. And back in the distance, they see something behind a curtain, and of course, you know, it's the wizard. And I'll mention, I have a running theme about Bill Clinton's proclivities here, and there's always a woman somewhere nearby. But having said that, let me say, we do this very tastefully, okay?
I can see where that could go sideways pretty easily.
I try to write my book so they're very family friendly. So there's nothing obscene, and you could read this to your, you know, 8-year-old, and your 8-year-old probably would never even pick up on what I'm joking about here.
That's true.
Very subtly and very tastefully.
All right, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, I almost forgot. Back on the Gorax, right? Isn't that the one where Salon.com gave you a review?
That was actually Salon.com reviewed the first one, the New Democrats.
Oh, it was the first one. All right, when we come back, we need to hear the review because it's super funny. Actually, okay. In later editions, he put it right on the book. If I would have brought my copy, I could have read it to you. You're listening to We the People Radio. Please join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We have tons of information about our guest today, Lawrence Bivak, and all of his books. We will be back talking about The Wizard of Iz in just a couple of minutes.
Sometimes late when things are real and people share the gift of gab between themselves. Some are quick to take the bait and catch the perfect prize that waits among the shells. But Oz never did give nothing to the Tin Man that he didn't already have. And cause never was a reason for the evening or the Tropic of Sir Galahad.
Road. Welcome back. You're listening to We the People Radio with Lawrence Bivak, author of The Wizard of Iz, which would be our Oz-themed music today.
I was going to congratulate you on the bump tunes.
Yeah, Bob's the master there.
I got a question for you. How did you, I mean, you're a master at this, but how did you come up with the idea of tying this to The Wizard of Oz? Because, I mean, it's such a great fit.
Oh, my goodness.
We want to see behind the curtain.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was, you know, just one epiphany. I mean, obviously, I'm working on a series here, and I already have, you know, two more ideas that are, you know, slowly moving from the back burner to the front burner about additional books I want to write. One, and it's the same theme. They're all parodies of famous children's books with conservative, free market, you know, capitalist messages. And there's one I want to do about education per se. You know, we touch on education in one page of Iz, but I want to do one that's specifically about all the craziness from the teachers' unions to the political correctness on campus and the crazy majors and the crazy professors. I mean, there's just so much you could do with just the topic of education. And I want to do a book just on that. And I also have one I want to do about, more broadly, about the general growth of government, how we used to have a government that did a few basic things that almost everyone can agree on, like, you know, keeping the streets safe and, you know, locking up, you know, dangerous criminals and protecting the country from foreign invasion, and how we step-by-step move from that to a government that's decided that every single corner of our lives has to be micromanaged for us. And so, one of those, probably the education one, is probably going to be my next book after this one gets, you know, settled in. I mean, it's done, but just, you know, I got to focus on marketing this one, and then we'll start, you know, working in earnest on the next one. But, I clearly wanted Hillary to be part of it. I wanted a female character, there's not a whole lot of examples of that. And then, you know, it was such a, you know, when you find the right book that fits your story, it just clicks, you know.
Oh, yeah.
All the craziness that you've got in the original, in the original version just works with the craziness in the world today. And as I started thinking of all the different things I wanted to do, you know, they all just found a place. It was very much, you know, the way, you know, when I was doing the original one, the New Democrat, that you know, thing one and thing two, you know, the cat's little helpers just became Pelosi and Reed. It was, you know, everything just fit into place.
Oh, and I almost forgot. What's your review on the New Democrat?
Oh, well, the line that I quoted, I remember really well. The day I first saw that review, and I was eagerly reading it, you know, and I knew, you know, from the second I started reading it, that I was looking for what line I was going to quote. And the line was that it's the most twisted piece of conservative propaganda print matter out there.
I'm thinking you hit a nerve. We had a bleeder.
The most twisted piece of conservative propaganda.
I can't wait till the review comes out.
And it was just so perfect, you know.
Oh, thank you.
You know, this is like I couldn't have made one up, you know, better myself.
That's fantastic.
Oh my gosh.
And in fact, I sent the guy a copy of the Gorax, the guy who wrote that in Salon.com. I mailed him a free copy of the Gorax with a letter thanking him for his first review and requesting him to review the second one. And he is not obliged to me. I'm a no-take. Maybe he figured out that he's on to me.
He's like, that guy's just messing with me. Oh, my gosh. Well, wait till they get a load of the Hillary one because, you know, I'm noticing a lot of the people that would typically be, you know, the Democrat supporters are like, yeah, but not Hillary. But, boy, you know what? There still is a group of true believers out there. This should send them into orbit.
Well, I'll tell you, I still think it's going to be Hillary. You know, it's between the absence of any real alternative, you know, on the Democratic side. And I'm sorry, Bernie Sanders, you know, ain't going to beat Hillary. And the fact that the Clintons have an incredible track record of being utterly immune to this stuff. One would be hard pressed to think what they would have to do to actually end their, you know, collective political career. And, you know, I can't really come up with anything would actually slow them down.
I see from this one picture you sent us with it's got a little picture of Elizabeth Warren with a knife in her back and a headdress. I'm assuming you're thinking she's probably not going to be a contender.
Knife in her back and headdress.
Well, the concept I had for Hillary is that, you know, just she's just utterly ruthless and wants what she wants, and anything that gets in the way, you know, has got to be destroyed. I'm sure you also noticed that in the background she's got kind of a dungeon where there's Ken Starr and Juanita Broderick in skeletalized form are strung up in her dungeon, and then there's a third place for Barack Obama, but he's escaped.
And you know, Obama,
and again, you know, I try to have enough subtlety here that, you know, I like when people come to me and say, I didn't quite figure it out until the third time I read your book.
Well, I think you're really on target. If you think about it, I say you're really on target there, because when you look at the real situation, so many of these political folks are afraid of her. I mean, they're afraid of that machine turning their guns on them.
Yeah, well, that's what they do. They kill. You know, they go after you. They're not playing.
No,
no.
If the Clintons are the political mafia of our day, they send out their hitmen who are playing for keeps. Well, so my idea was that Obama was like the one person who you know defeated them. In fact, at one point Hillary describes Obama as that slick jerk who robbed me of my birthright.
Yeah. Well, you look at the I don't know if you've watched the program House of Cards. I don't think there's any doubt of who they're portraying in that program.
Sure, sure. Or there was a movie that came out in the Clinton era too, Wag the Dog.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, the same thing. The absolute. You know, everything is fake. Everything is fun.
It's a pageant.
You know, it's a creation. Pageant. And yeah. So I have her as a kind of a. And to me, this is what Hillary is, as a dull, unimaginative, but you know, absolutely ruthless opportunist who, you know, has only one thought, and that is, you know, how do I get where I want to go? And whatever, you know, will get me there is good, and whatever is in my way is going to get destroyed. And I also had a very perhaps unusual thought about Bill Clinton, who's the wizard, and that is I decided I wanted to have him tell the truth. And this is probably one of the more weirder, risk-taking things that I did in the story. But Bill Clinton, always tells the truth. I wanted him to just blithely explain how the Clintons do what they do. And so back when they're meeting him in the palace, he explains to them, you know, how he controls the media. He can, you know, how he explains how the purpose of the welfare state is not to improve the economy, yet to keep poor people poor. And he explains that as people get poorer and poorer, their vote for the Democrats gets surer and surer.
Wow.
I mean,
I think is probably one of the more interesting literary things I do in this book is that I make Bill Clinton the one who, you know, unselfconsciously, you know, he's not apologizing for it. He's just, you know, I just had an image that we would catch him on a day where he's like, okay, this is what we do. You know, what's your point?
Yeah.
Okay. Of course we're trying to deceive everybody. Of course we don't want the economy to improve because, you know, if people became, you know, better off, they wouldn't need the Democrats anymore.
That's right. Dependence.
He literally is the Wizard of Oz because they look at the world in a completely different way and they manipulate the heck out of it. We need to take one last really quick break. We'll be back with Lauren Spivak. We are going to have him on here the second hour. So if you are listening to us in Philadelphia, please jump online, wethepeopleradio.us, and listen to the second half. Be right back. Two really good ones. Don't Mess with Bill and The Wicked Witch is Dead. And that Don't Mess with Bill was from where? The 50s? 60s?
Marvelettes, Motown, 60s.
God. All right,
yeah,
Lauren.
That's early 60s. I remember us.
Gosh. Geez, Lauren, if you could put a soundtrack on your book, I think we've got it for you. I think we have it handled.
I think you've certainly made the right selections.
I think Bob's the master yet again. So let's see. Let's recap for folks before the end of the hour. Why don't you do that, Lauren? Since they're your books, tell them how to get them and all that good stuff.
Well, you want me to talk more about the plot line or about how to get the book?
Let's do plot line next hour. But for the folks in Philadelphia that only get an hour of the program, well, let's give them all the details.
At this point, my website is obamaparody.com. At this point, I only have the first two books. So they're the only ones I physically have. I will have The Wizard of Oz in a couple weeks. And what I would suggest, for everybody, is to just email me. And I think my email, which is my name, Lauren Spivak, L-O-R-E-N-S-P-I-V-A-C-K, @gmail.com. they're a little bit more expensive on the website. I could probably get people a better deal. And moreover, if people are interested in pre-ordering the Wizard of Iz, I can take care of that. And then as soon as they come in, we'll get you your copy.
Well, we bought a ton of those first books, and they went so fast that everybody we gave them to just loved them. I mean, they wanted to know where to get more.
And the other thing is you have them when you come and do the seminars or when you just come to speak.
You can bring with me everywhere.
Yeah, so if you have a group of folks in your area that would like to get together and have Lauren either come and just speak to your group or come and do actually the two-night seminar, also email him and get on his schedule because he's driving all over the country all the time. All right. Sorry, we got all our brakes jammed up there at the end, but we are going to come back with Lauren in the second hour here, talk more about the plot line and the characters, and I'm sure we'll have more fun music. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll be right back with you.
Stay tuned for Hour 2 of We the People on KCNR Shasta Redding.
Welcome to We the People Radio. You're joining Aaron, Bill, and Bob, and our guest, Lauren Spivak, for the second hour. If you missed the first hour, you should definitely go back and listen. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. We appreciate your retweets of our program so that people find us. That seems to be the quickest way to find us. You can join us on Facebook, too. It just kind of sits there, but, I guess everybody says go like us on Facebook. So whatever, for whatever that's worth, go do that. definitely forward out this program because there's a ton of good information, and the best part about it is Lauren will travel to your town when it fits into his schedule, and he's always traveling. How many weeks of the year do you travel, Lauren? All of them?
Oh, my gosh. Not all of them.
51?
But I travel a lot, and obviously I'm trying to do pretty much the entire continental of the United States, so I kind of have to, develop a pattern, but I'll be in, I'm in the Virginia area for most of the next 6 weeks. I'm going to be in Ohio in July, and by early August and September, back in California again.
Right on. I know some guys.
California, you have no idea how big your state is until you've tried to speak to it all. I keep going back to California, and I leave feeling like I barely scratched the surface.
Oh, it's true. Well, that's why we only get knuckleheads for governors, because you have to be a, gazillionaire or have huge name recognition to hit this whole state. I'm not going to say it's impossible, because we still hold out hope we can get somebody besides a knucklehead, but it is very, very difficult, thanks to the geography, which would be why there's a really, really strong movement, actually, to split the state. And I wouldn't say in half, but to create a 51st state would help us a lot. Actually, we have very different politics, very different economic needs, very different geography and resources, and and then you could come and speak to yet another state. See, that'd be easier.
You can be my 26th state.
We can't actually shrink the geography. There would still be the same landmass, but it would
without going anywhere new.
It would be called a new state. Then it would feel better. It's a little bit like in the East Coast. You blow up through Connecticut, Massachusetts.
And a lot of people do believe that 57 states is enough.
Yeah, what is it?
I think, and as a New Englander, I've always felt that, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island really could pretty much combine together into one state because they're so small and there isn't really a dime's worth of difference between them.
That's really true.
The difference between San Diego and Redding is about as great a difference as, two cities could possibly have.
Yeah, Texas and Alaska.
Yeah, wildly different. Well, So all geography lessons aside, I do know some folks in Virginia, so I'll get a hold of them next week and see if you're already speaking to them or not. And they're right there. Shoot, got 6 weeks. Yeah, we've got resources over there. And now the last hour of the show it'll air in Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore this coming Tuesday. So they'll have your information, which is great. And make sure we leave that all up online all week so people can go there and check it out. So let's see. You have three seminars. Do we call them all economic literacy?
Well, no, economic literacy is my first seminar.
Oh, that's what it's called. Okay.
Yes, it's called economic literacy. The second one, Getting There From Here, is really a political seminar. It's about political strategy. But strategy, I don't find other people talking about. I'll tell you, if I have a thought and I look around and everyone else is already talking about it, then I really don't need to bother. But what I try to do is talk about a lot of ideas that I'm really not hearing about practically how to shrink the government, my ideal is to get an administration there, not simply that has an R after their name, but that is committed to making government smaller than it is now. And even the word smaller has become corrupted. When Republicans, sadly, when most Republicans say smaller, what they mean is that, smaller than the Democrats, would like to make it. Which, means smaller than infinity. It means essentially nothing. I think smaller should mean of a lesser size than it is today.
Yeah, not a slower amount of growth. Let's back it up a little bit and shrink it.
But that's right, reduction. And what we do know from historical experience is the few times that this has actually been tried, and the three that stand out for me are, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher in Britain and the Harding-Coolidge administration in the United States at the end of the First World War. And in all three cases, it led to an instant economic boom. A lot of people forget that we had a big recession in 1920, but then Harding and Coolidge shrunk the federal government. We suddenly, within months, are in an economic boom that not only ensures, Coolidge's reelection, but it ensures, your Republican dynasty. And Margaret Thatcher achieved the same thing in Britain in the 80s. And so what I've been telling groups of late is that if we elect a Republican president next year, and for whatever reason he decides to do nothing, the economy will continue to stink, it will continue to go nowhere, and within a few months it'll be the Republicans' fault. And the Democrats will say, I would be surprised if any one of your listeners doubt me on this, within a few months the Democrats will be saying that it's all the Republicans' fault, and then what we need is lots more socialism. Clearly, you don't have enough socialism because the economy is so bad, and that's what the solution is. And then the Republican will be forced to run for re-election, defending the status quo. And this is just, to me, this is just a nightmare. Whereas, alternatively, if we have a Republican administration, and I'm pretty sure we'll have a Republican Congress too, that's committed to left government, then you will have the kind of boom we saw in the United States under Reagan, in Britain under Thatcher, and the United States, with Harding and Coolidge, where the economy really grows and you can turn a whole generation into Republicans. And this is the great hinge of faith here is not so much on Election Day as on what gets done after Election Day. And I would be absolutely, reduced to tears if the Republicans win this in 2016 and elect to squander it all by doing nothing.
That would be...
Yeah, and unfortunately, with the whole presidential deal, if you polled, 10 people between the age of 18 and 25 and asked them who the last three presidents were, they probably couldn't tell you. And that's the voting base we're looking at right now. They're just woefully uninformed. and they don't really understand who the players are in this mega system we have now. And I don't know. I guess I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if we do have a Republican president and a Republican House and Senate, do you really think they're going to take their one shot and make change? Because I think your cowardly lion depiction is
pretty true. We have a very different group of Republicans now than you've had in the past. In 2010, we loaded in a different, you know.
Yeah, you still have the power base in there.
And you also have people watching.
I was going to say, I think it's possible. I think it's about who it is. And I'll tell you something else. I mean, I bemoan the fact that young people are ignorant of what's going on in the world as much as anybody does. In fact, this is something which we talk about in my third seminar, The Search for Superhuman Wisdom, you know, where we're looking for wisdom, as the title implies. And one of the things that we talk about is that people are frequently, they say one of the reasons why I think democracy is such a imperfect system is that people tend to vote based on ignorance. People vote based on, you know, weird feelings of, you know, connectedness to something or other. You know, whether it's simply an ethnic identity. I can remember in 1988, when I lived in Brooklyn, and the Greek community in Brooklyn was just ecstatic about Michael Dukakis running for president. He was Greek. And it's like, yeah, how silly is this? You know, who cares? You know, I care about his policies.
Well,
but you know, people tend to vote based on really silly things. And on the other hand, I'll tell you the good news in this. Do you know what people, including ignorant people, including young people, will understand? They will understand the difference between a booming economy and a going-nowhere economy. Okay? The most ignorant among us, most of them, there's a few exceptions, but the majority understand that the economy is going nowhere today. And if you bring in the right kind of Republican president, you know, the next Ronald Reagan, who shrinks the government, because there's nothing that's slowing down the U.S. economy other than the U.S. government. That is the problem. There's nothing else. And he shrinks the government, and the economy booms. They will know the economy is booming. Ronald Reagan turned, and I was there. Heck, I was one of them. Ronald Reagan turned a whole generation of young people into Republicans because they saw it happen.
Right, and it gets back to the same thing.
He made it happen.
You hit him in the checkbook.
Margaret Thatcher turned a whole generation of young Britons into conservatives because she made it work. The lesson, and again, this is very much what The Wizard of Oz is about, the Democrats are always going to be better at communication. They're always going to be better spin doctors than we are. And that's just the way it is, okay? They spin like nobody's business. The one thing that the conservative movement has that they don't is we actually know how to make the economy work. And if we do it, that message will beat any spin. People know when their fortunes are soaring upward, as they did in all those three examples I gave you, and that will turn the electorate around. Because the reason that I will be absolutely, you know, despondent if the Republicans screw this up is because there is such an opportunity here to demonstrate what really can happen and the good that can come of it. And what terrifies me is the thought of throwing that away and having a generation never see what a difference capitalism can make, and then they'll just be left to the spin that the Democrats give.
Well,
that's really the decision that we're making.
Yeah,
and I agree. I agree 100%. And I think one of the hurdles we have to overcome, excuse me, is they had a chance before.
And they
blew it big time.
The public is very, look at the public though. Look at the way people were paying attention back then, which they weren't because they were making money.
Oh, yeah.
They were busy.
There was a lot of money flowing.
Now look at who's watching.
No,
so the
true.
Accountability is very, very different, and that creates a different outcome.
No, you're right.
Of course I'm right. Because now we have to go to a break, and everyone can just savor how right I was.
Well, you're going to hear about it. Well, fortunately, the folks out there won't hear what I got to say after
Bill's
break.
Got some pointy back scratcher thing. He's like,
bludgeoning
somebody. Waving around. I'm gonna go fight off the back scratcher. We'll be back with you in 2 minutes. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. All right, that's it.
All right, come here.
You're listening to We the People Radio on Community Talk Radio for the North State, AM 1460 KCNR.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within. Smiling faces, smiling faces. Sometimes they don't tell the truth. Smiling faces, smiling faces tell lies, and I've got proof.
It's all about the music. You're rejoining We the People Radio. Hop online, check out the webpage, wethepeopleradio.us. It has everything about our guest, Lauren Spivak, his three books, seminars, talks. He's like the only guy who's actually smart and funny at the same time that I know of that speaks for free to pretty much any size group, I think. Because, you know, a lot of people speak for free, but there's a reason it's free. And so we just wanted to dispel that myth right now. It's worth money, he just doesn't charge you.
So I'm dying to know. You know, we talked a little bit about the plot on your next book. Does the cowardly lion get courage?
Does he get?
Or the cowardly rhino? Does he end up with courage in the end?
Well, what happens is they, when they're with the they meet Hillary in her lair, and she's got remember the flying monkeys.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so they're all government union people. Basically, they're a bunch of union goons who beat up the witch's opponents. So they basically kidnap our heroes and bring them into the witch's lair. And what happens? And this is, you know, obviously I'm endeavoring to create some suspense here, but the red box. Remember the red box that she's been carrying through this entire story.
Yeah.
Gets dropped, and it bursts open, and what pops out of it is all of the wisdom of the American founding, and even beyond. It's John Locke and Hume and James Madison and Calvin Coolidge and Friedrich Hayek and Abraham Lincoln and Bastiat and like all of the great scholars of freedom throughout history, and all of their wisdom pops out. And let me take a moment here to give a thank you to my illustrator, because this, you know, it's tough to illustrate conceptions like this, and this one I actually think was done really brilliantly, where all of this wisdom comes out of the box about how, you know, a wise and frugal government which will not take from the mouth of labor the bread it's earned, you know, Jefferson did, all of this stuff pops out and basically destroys the witch. They say what she can't deal with, you know, is all of this truth, and she melts.
So truth
and she's
melts.
Gone.
Yeah.
And the flying monkeys, who are all labor union goons, you know, realize, you know, that the spell is broken. You know, now they'd rather be free, independent people than simply, you know, enforcers for this political regime. And so the entire gang heads back to the Emerald City to re-meet the wizard. And there's a couple things I did here. One is to have Bill Clinton utterly unconcerned about the fate of Hillary. That was one of the themes I wanted to have. And And the second, as I said, is that he is going to actually, not because he's not the good guy at all, but because he doesn't care. You know, he's just neutral. You know, that he's going to tell him the whole truth about all of this. So he explains to the Scarecrow that you don't learn stuff from going to an Ivy League school and listening to a bunch of left-wing blowhards, you know, blather about their crazy theories. You learn stuff by doing. And the Scarecrow is like, you know, so I don't just have to repeat things that I'm told. I can actually make my own unique contribution to the world and learn how to do things and satisfy other people's needs and thus advance myself. And then the Tin Man, and this is, again, you know, the great thing about writing books, what makes writing books addictive, is that there's certain ideas, you know, that I really deeply believe in, and I get to, like, you know, fill my books with them. And the second one is that the Tin Man's lesson is that how you help the poor is to produce stuff, not to pay taxes. Government does not help the poor, and I'm certainly not opposed to charity, but I'll tell you, Henry Ford helped poor people by making cars. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. He created jobs.
He gave to charity too. And that's lovely.
Right.
But he really helped the poor by making cars, because Henry Ford did not invent the car. People think he invented it. He did not. He invented the inexpensive car. Rich people had cars before Henry Ford. Henry Ford had to figure out how to make them cheap enough so that regular people could buy one. And that's what really was the revolution. Sam Walton, you know, who founded Walmart to help the poor by bringing goods to market more cheaply than other retailers were. So people's, you know, limited money went further. And this is how you help the poor. So that's what the Tin Man's lesson is that capitalism isn't something you should be ashamed of, and helping the poor is not something you do to make amends for your having been a capitalist. The fact is, the capitalist makes money at the exact same instant that he's improving someone else's life, because that's what capitalism is.
So, if we take that a step further, one of my experiences here in the last week was I saw a whole group of homeless people in a parking lot. It was after 5, you know, the sun was going down, and it was getting late, and they were popping out of the bushes and just congregating in this parking lot. And the thing that amazed me was probably 90% of them had a cell phone. So I guess Apple helped the poor, too.
And I know that businesses are helping, because the fence blew down in our parking lot, and so now the homeless kind of, I don't know, it's a little bit of like a camp, I guess, on the other side of the fence that we didn't know anything about because there was a fence there, didn't see it. Now they're all using our outside power outlets to charge all their electronic devices,
yeah.
And they have a lot of them. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Welcome
yeah.
to the 21st
I need to get out more. Things have
changed. I'm not bashing on the porn. I'm not bashing on the homeless, but
oh, you are.
Without capitalism, without the American people's ability to produce.
Sure, to pay the taxes that bought the phones.
Exactly. I mean, that's what makes our system work.
That's what you need to do, Lauren. Do a book that's a parody on the house that Jack built. Because you know what I mean? The people that went to work so that they could earn a living, so they could pay the taxes, so that, the people who don't can have all these things.
Sure, but it's at the end of the day, you know, who feeds the person who's hungry?
Exactly.
You know, the farmer who grows crops. You know, does the guy in the government printing office who prints off food stamps, is he feeding the poor?
Or the guy
no.
that regulates the farmer and makes it impossible for him to.
Well, look what happens
food?
To charities when we're in a great recession and nobody has any money. What happens then? What happens to these charities that, you know, survive on, you know, the good heart of people that provide them the money to operate? It goes away.
in a recession.
Sure, but again, I'm taking this a step farther than you are, and I'm not disagreeing with you. I just want people to take this one step farther. The charities are very, very nice. I have nothing against the charity. But it is the capitalist engaged in capitalism helps the poor more than when that same capitalist is engaged in charity.
No, I think we're saying the same thing. No, I totally agree with that.
So it's the production, it's the innovation, it's things like that. Well, you mentioned about the cell phones. When I was a kid, there were, I don't know if we called them cell phones, they were like car phones. But, like, super-duper rich people had a phone in their car. You know, the President of the United States would have a phone in his car. Maybe a multi-millionaire would have a phone in his car. The idea that regular people would have a phone in their car, you know, would have seemed absurd to me when I was a kid in the 1970s. And now, every kid, every 12-year-old in the playground has got his own cell phone. Okay? That huge improvement came from people... from capitalists seeking to make money, not to improve the human condition, but to make money. And as Adam Smith, explained 240 years ago, it's the invisible hand of the market. You help people by when you seek to make money, even though that's not your original, intention, it doesn't matter. And all government really does is get in the way of that process and slow down the growth of the economy, which is what actually helps the poor and raises all the boats.
Exactly. And we will pursue this on the backside of a little break we have to take. We're talking to Lawrence Bivack, and you can find everything you need to find about him and his books and seminars and speaking and all that good stuff on wethepeopleradio.us.
Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet.
Yeah, we're monkeys, and people say we're monkeying around. But we're too busy singing to put anybody down.
Amen. Hey, Lauren, I got a question for you. We're talking about the producers and free markets. Do you think that we've gone down this road so far with, free this and free that, and so many people now are on government assistance of some sort? Do you think the voting base is going to be willing to give up some of that free stuff for a job, for a new way of life, of making it on your own? I mean, there's just so many people out there that depend on, even depend on mom and dad, and they're 40 years old. I mean, do you think we've kind of crossed a threshold here where we can't come back from that?
Well, it is a great and very, very relevant question, and my answer is no, I don't think so. I really don't believe that there are irreversible lines you can cross and you can't go back. Karl Marx, who comes up in The Wizard of Oz, comes up at the end. Karl Marx, believed in this deterministic concept of history, that history moves from this point to this point and this point, and that's the way it's got to go, and there's no going back. And I do reject that. Now, that's not to say that everything is for sure going to be fine. I think that history is dependent on the decisions that all of us make every day, because we're here today. It's our world. We're living in it. We make things happen or not happen. But I don't believe that anything is determined. And I'll give you two examples of that. Britain, by 1979, was significantly more socialist than the United States is today. It was an absolute mess. The economy was a disaster area. That Britain was the sick man of Europe was what was the line that everyone was, you know, quoting. One third of everybody in Britain lived in government-owned housing. One third of the entire population lived in housing owned by the government. Virtually all the major industries, the British Steel, British Telecom, British Airways, virtually every major industry, British Coal, you know, if it had the word British in it, that meant it was run by the government. They were all socialized government entities. And the unions that represented the workers basically, you know, just had a stranglehold on the entire country. And Thatcher came in, and she didn't just reverse that. She showed people how much better a life they could have without this. Because I do not believe that the people on welfare, you know, in the housing projects, you know, have a great life because of what the government's given them. And she showed them what was better and completely changed politics in Britain. What was fascinating, and this is like you could do a political science term paper just on this or a PhD dissertation, is how Margaret Thatcher changed the Labour Party. That is, not her party, the other party. The Labour Party, when Margaret Thatcher took office as a conservative, had specifically endorsed, you know, complete socialism. The government ought to run the entire economy. That was their official platform. Did you know that after a few years of Thatcher, they were forced to change it? Because people realized how much better they had it under Thatcher's small government free market policies, she forced the Labour Party, the opposition party, to the right. They when she privatized the government-owned housing, she allowed people to buy the housing that they lived in that was owned by the government, and said, you can now buy it, it's yours, and you can sell it, and let your kids marry, whatever you want. And initially, the Labour Party was hugely against this. They were screaming that this was how outrageous this was. After a couple years, they changed the Labour Party platform retroactively to agree that that was the right thing to do. Okay? So you can change this. What's missing in our country today is the political will. But, you know, that's on us. And if you want even better, I'll give you an even more extreme example than that. Let's look at China. Now, the government of China today, as a government, you know, stinks. They're totally repressive. There's no free speech. You know, all the kinds of freedoms that we would want are not there. But the China in the 1970s was one of the poorest countries in the world per capita. They, I believe, had a per capita income of something like $50 per person, you know, a year. That's what you lived on for a year, with a dollar a week in the 1970s in China. And what they decided to do in the 80s was to embrace capitalism, not political freedom, which is unfortunate, but they did embrace capitalism, and now their economy is actually officially now bigger than the United States economy. Their economy has been booming for a couple decades now because they decided to embrace capitalism. And I think we can all agree that China, under Mao Zedong, had, you know, we may not like Obama, but I think we agree that China, Mao Zedong's China, was even farther in a government-controlled, you know, direction than the United States is. And so those are two examples in our lifetime where countries have gone farther left than we have and come back and discovered the kind of prosperity for everybody that capitalism causes. So, no, it is never too late. It's never over. And, you know, whatever happens, the sun will rise the next morning, and we got a world to and decide, you know, where we want to move it.
Yeah, so there. And you know what, that's a, we should point out, in all of these books, they're not just, it's not just making fun of whatever the, you know, whether it's, you know, the New Democrat or the Gorax or the Wizard of Iz, it's not just to pull out all the stuff that's truly absurd and make fun of it. Every single one of those books has actually a really upbeat ending and shows possibilities for how that can be fixed.
You know, absolutely. I try to, you know, I've got something of a formula here that I'm trying to, you know, play out differently, but to stick with the formula. And one of them is that I always try to be upbeat at the end, and I always reflect it back to the reader at the end. If you notice, all of my last lines of all three books, you know, go back to the reader and say, you know, are you ready to do something about this? In effect, although, you know, in different ways. And if you want, I can tell you real quick, I think we've got just the last page or two that we haven't covered in terms of the narrative.
Yeah, go for it.
The third character to get his questions answered, and you had asked me about this, is the Cowardly Rhino. And he is told that you're making this mistake, that what people want is moderation. And this is obviously something I feel very strongly about. I think it is the dumbest, most incorrect political idea in America today that the Republicans do better by being moderate and appealing to the middle. And it is an absolute lie. It's worth noting that the Democrats believe no such thing. When the Democrats lose an election, do they look for somebody more moderate next time? They look for somebody, you know, even when I don't even think it's possible for them to find anyone farther to the left. They do. They find someone farther to the left than the person they lost with last time.
And she wears a Mao outfit.
that's right. And so anyhow, so the Cowardly Rhino is taught that, people are not looking for a moderate. People are looking for a solution. They're looking for someone who has core beliefs and principles that can lead us to a better future, and that you're abdicating your entire responsibility here by allowing the Democrats to paint you into this corner where you're like, oh, I'll just split the difference, we'll be halfway. Nobody wants that. That excites nobody. Whereas if you can paint a net as Reagan did, as Thatcher did, as Coolidge did, these were some of the most electorally successful conservatives in the entire history of the Western world. Those three people right there, what they all did is they clearly, unambiguously had a message of maximum freedom and minimal government, and then they demonstrated how well it worked, and people loved it. So that is what the Rhino is taught. At the end, he throws away his white flag and picks up an American flag instead. I love the symbolism. And the hardest issue I had to deal with, and I had written most of this book before I figured out, to be honest, what I was going to do with Dorothy. I was trying to think about how to get her back home again. You know, I had this image of balloons, you know, taking her back home to, you know, to the world that she came from. And I finally realized that that was all a mistake, and that it was time, you know, for another plot twist. And that what the correct answer, and this is what Hillary is told, excuse me, not Hillary, but Dorothy is told, is that she can't go back. That nobody can go back. Going back in time is not an option. And I think this was the message I realized that I wanted to give. Because people say, oh, you know, I wish I could go back to the era of Ronald Reagan. Well, you can't. Okay? So face up to that. You can't do that. What you can do is change the world that we're in today. And that's what Dorothy learns, is that the one option that is open to you is you can make the world of today better. And that one of the lines is that if you can change history, and the history books will talk about you the same as the heroes that you look up to, you know, from previous times. And the wizard, you know, realizes he's late for his 8 o'clock date, and the four heroes are left to decide how they're going to change the direction that the country is going into. And I think the last line of the book is, "How about you?"
It always returns to, yeah, the reader. And what are you going to do? So now that you've enjoyed all this fun, the kind of, you know, I guess in a nice way, sort of pokes him in the chest a little bit. And it's like, you are part of the solution. And we require, you know, it's required that you become part of it.
That's right. Uh, and, uh, And, you know, the future is in our hands. You know, there's a time before we're born and a time after we die when we don't have any impact at all. But, you know, here we are and we can. And it's not, you know, a job for one person. This is something that we're all involved in. You know, obviously, you know, I try to do my thing in the books that I'm writing. And I like to think that this is having a positive effect on the debate. And, you know, you guys have a great radio show where you're doing it, and this is not, you know, it's a huge mistake to say this is a job for those people or these people or that guy. It's a job for every one of us. There's a million things that need to be done if we're going to change the direction of the country, and every one of us had a piece of it.
Exactly, and sitting around, so you know the book is interesting. It's a great play on real life. You know, sitting around making fun of it is fine, but at the end of the day, you have a responsibility, and I think that's the part that a lot of people have not quite come to grips with, is because they feel like, well, I'm not in elected office, or you know, my vote doesn't count. There's so much voter fraud; it doesn't matter.
Well, and
nobody's
that's the
conservative
effect
enough.
That,
blah blah blah.
That's the effect of what's happened in our government. I mean, it's caused people to lose heart, and it's caused people to just realize, you know what, I don't need a job. I'll just, you know, go on government assistance, and, you know, if something comes my way, I'll take it. If I make more than I'm making on... I mean, I've had people turn jobs down because the government assistance is more than what I'm willing to pay them to work. And I mean, that's a sad state of affairs. We've got to change that around. You're absolutely right. I think everybody has a role to play in that. And that, I guess that's what I like about your books, is it really exposes the lunacy of so many of these policies and actions by these people that are currently, you know, in power. They're playing everybody.
Well, and the mainstream media, of course, just fans the flames. It's kind of like, you know, it's hopeless. You can't do anything about it
right. Anyway.
And so you might as well just stay home.
Yeah.
And, of course, if people do that, that creates its own...
More of the
that
same.
Creates its own train
more
wreck.
Same.
Bob, do we have another break we have to take? We do, don't we? I knew I was behind on something. There was something nagging at me. All right, one more quick break. We'll come back and finish up the hour with Lauren Spivak, author of The Wizard of Iz, and a couple other great books. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, and you can get all the information there. Nice, Bob. Little Hillary theme song there. We got a lot of good Bill and Hillary songs on here. Oh my gosh!
This may be the best job of all, is picking your bump tunes.
Oh my gosh! Well, see, that's why we have to have our show on Sunday, because that's when Bob's the engineer. So we realized we had a combination that worked, and we didn't want to screw up the mix.
It is a great job.
It is pretty awesome. Hey, and Bob had a question during the break, but I told him just ask it himself.
Well, I was just curious. We didn't get too much into it in the previous hour, but some of the plot lines that actually involve Hillary herself, we haven't learned too much about that yet in the Wizard of Iz.
Well, Hillary does not play that big a role in the plot. It's you know, she's like the witch in the Wizard of Oz. You know, she's there, she's a central figure, and there's a fair amount of humor that's on those, you know, couple of pages. But, you know, I'm very deliberately trying to put this in a bigger context, because I don't think, and I think it's a mistake to think that, you know Hillary is not, you know, a good person and not someone I want to see as president. But to say that she is the problem really is overselling her. She is representative of the problem. Okay, she isn't the problem, and the problem is this larger, you know, governing consensus that we need to address. And it actually somewhat annoys me when I hear all the Republican candidates spend all their time, you know, going after Hillary, which is fine, you know, in the long run they're going to have to do that, but I would really like to see them developing an alternative vision for American governance.
I think that makes sense, because there wouldn't be a Hillary if there wasn't a supporting framework, I guess, to allow that to happen.
And exactly. So I've got, you know, when you do what I do, which is, you know, books that, you know, the original Wizard of Oz book, you know, has thousands of words, and, you know, mine's got a few hundred. You know, I've got to keep it very tight. Because I don't want, you know, I don't have space to, you know, get into sidetracks, you know, very much. And there's like key issues I want to touch. And what to me is the issue is facing us in the 2016 election is how we're going to deal with the size and scope of government, how we're going to deal with education and taxation, and political corruption and the news media. You know, and Hillary is in the center of it all, but she is not the sum total of it. So, and as you point out, and I think you have probably, there's three or four, you know, pages or five pages where Hillary actually appears. You have probably the middle of those in your book, where, you know, it deals with, you know, the donations to the Clinton, the laundry chute, yeah. where the donations to the Clinton Foundation are pouring in to her room, and there's her email server, and you know, and her dungeon and all of these other things.
Yeah, but I like that her dungeon is filled with her books.
So there's a running joke that her books are just a drug on the market. They're piled up everywhere in the story, because, you know, She got like a multi-million dollar advance, and I think they sold about 14 books.
It's true. There's just a zillion of them. It's hilarious. At first I was like, what does that say?
No, they're in Costco now.
And I started looking at the box title. Oh, Hard Choices. Okay.
Yeah. They're heading off to buck a book at a record pace, at a record speed.
Buck a book.
And she says... She says, who cares if they're terrorists who hate Christians and Jews, when I can just blame a video that got 26 views?
any other thoughts for us here in the last, like, you know, minute and a half?
Well, it's, you know, I look at this, and it's a cliche to say that, you know, this is a turning point in history, but, you know, everything's a turning point in history, and it is. And I guess what I want people to focus on is, you know, what the real issues and the real choices are facing our country going forward, and the importance of people who care, you know, getting involved. And I try to bring that into all of the books, and try to explore, you know, different corners of our society. One of the things I talk about in my third seminar is, which gets into history a lot, and we talk about, you know, what's the real lesson of history. And I believe that the real lesson of all history is that every generation has its own version of insanity. It does something that's just insane, and future generations will always look back and say, my gosh, they were insane. How could they have believed that? You know, that's how we feel when we look back at the Salem witch trials, or, you know, medieval doctors bleeding people to death. You know, we look back at these periods of history, my God, how could anyone have believed that?
And
well, the trick is to understand the insanity in our own time. That it's easy to pick out some previous generation's insanity, but if you understand the insanity in our own time, And that's what I'm trying to touch on, you know, the left-wing news media, the crazy idea that government spending is good for the economy, environmentalism are all examples of our own craziness, and that's what we need to deal with.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you very much for coming
on. You have done such a good job with it. Mr. Lawrence Bevec.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks again. So join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. All the information is there about our guest, Lawrence Bevec. Next week, we will be all about Normandy. You guys are going to love it.
And you're listening to KCNR Shasta.